NHPR.com. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from this week's top news stories.
Another police officer arrived and entered the home, but was driven out by gunfire. Other officers arrived, and a short time later, the home was engulfed in flames and later exploded.
Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And that was Steve, and all of you are his friends, every one of you. Steve has no regrets, I can tell you that.
I actually had somebody who told me after the botched execution in Oklahoma a couple weeks ago that in some ways it made them rethink the vote that they had taken to keep the death penalty in the state of New Hampshire.
SB 207 is a significant investment in our economy. Working people, particularly young working women, will know that New Hampshire values their contributions and provides for redress when their rights are violated.
4 months ago, 5 months ago, no one really knew who I was, and then everything just changed, and I'm still in shock. Like, it hasn't even caught up to me yet. I still feel like I am the same Alex, you know?
Say something, I'm giving up on you. I'm sorry that I couldn't get to you.
From the top, that was State Attorney General Joseph Foster on the shooting death of Brentwood Police Officer Stephen Arkell on Monday, followed by Lieutenant David Roy, a colleague and lifelong friend of Arkell's, who spoke at a vigil the following day. Then we heard from Democratic Representative Rennie Cushing, voicing his support for one final attempt this year to repeal the death penalty. The bill passed the House earlier this week. Next was Representative Shannon Chanley on the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is headed to Governor Hassan's desk. And finally, American Idol finalist Alex Preston, who returned to his home state of New Hampshire this past weekend for a celebration, parade, and concert. Preston was voted off the show last night. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you as we examine these and other stories. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests on the roundup this week are Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be back, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
And joining us again, Dan Tuohy, state editor for Patch.com, which has 12 news websites around the Granite State. And Dan, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
Well, Kevin, I want to start with you, but all of you, of course. The death of this Brentwood police officer, Stephen Arkell, it's a terrible story, happened on Monday. And Kevin, what do we know so far about this? Because there's a lot of unknowns, but what do we know?
Yeah, there really is. The officer, Stephen Arkell, was responding to a domestic disturbance between son and father in the home. He talked with the father outside the home and appeared to get him calmed down enough, but allowed him to come into the house, and that's where Stephen Arkell was shot fatally several times. What's really so agonizing about this story is Stephen Arkell is a really respected police officer in Brentwood. He's a part-time police officer, works one day a week, Mondays, the day where he walked into that home. Also an accomplished carpenter, a youth sports coach, just a beloved person in the community, and just to be snuffed out like that in a senseless act. I think the town has been completely rocked. I mean, Brentwood's a very bucolic, very peaceful place where it's the county seat, where the county jail is and the county courthouse. It's considered an extremely safe community, and to have something like this happen is just thoroughly troubling for everyone involved.
Well, it just makes you want to cry when you hear about Stephen Arkell and just his love and commitment and his family, and it's terrible. And Dan Tuohy, this also happened in a 55-plus community, so one of those, you know, sort of older folks communities that we hear so much about.
Yes, I mean, I haven't been at the scene. It's a very nice neighborhood. As Kevin mentioned, it's a very bucolic town. It's very much like a New Hampshire town you'd find in any of the 10 counties. Some great people live in that town. But also, it's like state flags are at half staff through Officer Arkell's funeral on Thursday. And, of course, the services are Tuesday and Wednesday. But also, just coming so close to the Greenland fatality of, you know,
right, not
Chief
that far
Mike
away.
Maloney.
Yeah,
especially for the Seacoast and that community, everyone is tight knit. Those departments are very much similar in their operations. Very small departments, community policing. So it's really, really, really touches a nerve over there.
Well, so you were over there, Dan, and a day or two after this happened, it seemed like all of a sudden all information kind of stopped while the Attorney General's office investigates. But there's some really unanswered questions, right, Dan? Like there was an explosion and a fire and the house was leveled. I mean, it went beyond this shooting.
Exactly. You know, Attorney General Joe Foster, Associate AG Jane Young, ATF, FBI, they're still investigating. And I believe there's still people on the scene today.
Yeah. Looking at what happened.
Yes.
Dean, your thoughts.
Hey, it's a tragedy. Anytime a first responder dies in serving the public like this, it is a remarkable scene. Although I was not there personally, I saw that footage of the house exploding. And it's interesting. What often happens, and it has now happened after the fact, is you start hearing from neighbors that this shooter was in his late 40s, had lived at home with his parents his whole life. There have been a lot of very loud arguments. This is a 50-plus, 55-plus community. So it's an attached duplex sort of setup where the neighbors lost, I think their pets were killed in the explosion and their belongings. So, you know, it's just an overall tragedy. And you always wonder, you know, people have recriminations, you know, if they knew that this individual was volatile or this had been a volatile relationship, you know, is there something that could have been done? And, you know, it's hindsight, but that kind of compounds the tragedy when you hear that people around this particular family knew that there were problems between the father and son.
Well, and Kevin, we still don't know how he died, the shooter died.
That's correct. We don't.
That's the odd thing.
Right. And we don't know exactly. It hasn't been confirmed the cause of the explosion. The home had propane in it, and many, many witnesses thought it appeared to be kind of a gas-like looking explosion, the way it just went up in a ball of fire. That's often what happens with a gas explosion. But we don't know what caused that explosion. We don't know exactly how he died.
All right. Well, when we gather next week for the roundup, there'll probably be some more information. I do want to ask all of you about another story that was a little bit, Dean Spiliotis, linked to this terrible story in Brentwood. The House once again voted this week in favor of death penalty repeal. How did this incident come up in this discussion, if at all, Dean?
Sure. Well, just a little bit of background. We had the vote recently on the death penalty. We had that the House had passed it easily. The Senate voted 12-12 tie. They tabled it, which means a similar bill could come back up at some point. The House has now voted again in favor of repealing the death penalty. So it was a 226-110 vote. They're going to send that to the Senate. You know, the supporters of this repeal and those who brought a bill back up have said, you know, first of all, in the wake of the botched Oklahoma execution, where there are lots of questions about how the execution was carried out, and now, you know, you have parallel. Well, the difference in this case is the shooter was killed in the explosion. In the Michael Briggs case, you had the Addison on death row for killing a police officer. And under our death penalty statute in the state, police are killing a police officer is a capital crime. So,
officers often say this protects them.
Protects them. Yes. So in theory, if the shooter had not been killed in the explosion, he might also have faced the death penalty. So that's how, you know, opponents of the repeal have kind of brought this in as well. But supporters of the repeal have initially used the Oklahoma botched execution as a reason to kind of reconsider.
All right. Well, I want to let everybody know that we'll be devoting a good chunk of our show on Monday to this death penalty repeal attempt. So we'll talk more about it then on Monday in the Exchange. Right now, you can join us on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. Dan Tuohy, I wanted to ask you about a big story out of the State House this week. Governor Hassan announces an executive order to cut back on spending. When and why did she do this?
Oh, she announced this week, of course, she'll be bringing it to the Legislative Fiscal Committee this upcoming week. Really, it's because of April's revenues being below projection. I think that it's around in the neighborhood of $22 million, which on one
hand, just for April.
That's the hole they're looking at.
Yeah. Go ahead, yeah.
So, you know, this is one of those stories that this happens. I mean, it's not the first time there's been an executive order for a freeze like this for spending, for out of state travel, for equipment. And agencies that need some of these priority spending, they can go to the legislative committee to get a waiver to do so. But it's just part of the budget that's always a moving target.
Did she say, Dan, what she thinks is causing the state's revenues to slow down?
One of the things she did say was as a result of some changes in tax law and some of the state laws, and that's why. But, you know, the economy is going up and down.
Kevin, you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. There's an interesting story in that, as Dan said, the real concern here is about business tax breaks and interest and dividends tax breaks that were granted by the Republican-led legislature in 2012. Now, why now? Because April is the big month for interest and dividend revenue. It's also – April is a big month for companies that pay the business profits tax. For many of them, it's their first quarterly payment. So this was the first time you would see these changes. Now, then Governor John Lynch vetoed those bills with tax breaks in them. He raised serious concerns about the losses in revenue, and the Republican-led legislature overrode him. This is not the first time we have done this rodeo here. The Republican-led legislature in 2011 granted a significant tax break on the communication services tax. Thought it was only $5 million. It ended up being $25 million. We're fearful this may be the same thing. It looked like a small tax break. Could be a whopper.
All right. Well, coming up, a Gallup survey finds New Hampshire among the most generous states, a result which contradicts previous other studies, which rank us as among the stingiest. How would you rank our charitable status? Let us know in just a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. Mostly cloudy, a chance of showers across New Hampshire today. Muggy, too. High temperatures in the lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com. From North Branch Construction, celebrating 56 years in business, from custom-built homes to eco-friendly commercial buildings, on time, on budget, on Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. And from Landmark College, Putney, Vermont, offering 2 and 4 year degrees for students who learn differently with an open house on June 14th, landmark.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Or give us a call. Again, it's 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin Landrigan, Dean Spiliotis, Dan Tuohy, I do want to talk about that Gallup survey, which finds New Hampshire among the most generous state, which goes against what a lot of other studies have found. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But Dean, a story that kind of blew up later in the week, made national news today. The Los Angeles Times, the U.S. News and World Report has to do with a controversy in the small, lovely town of Wolfboro. A police commissioner there, while out at a local restaurant, called President Obama the N-word and admitted that he did when someone confronted about it, saying the president, quote, meets and exceeds his criteria for use of the word. Now this is national news, Dean. What happened?
Yeah, this type of story is tailor-made to go viral and to go national. It turns out we now have a local version of Donald Sterling, the owner of the LA Clippers, who's gotten into hot water for some racially charged comments. This is a local story in Wolfboro. Apparently, the commissioner was police commissioner was speaking rather loudly at a restaurant, and a resident heard it and filed a complaint. It was a combination expletive and racial slur. And as you mentioned, Commissioner Copeland has doubled and now, after last night's meeting, tripled down in defense of himself and his refusal to back down. This is an elected position. If he doesn't resign, some residents have threatened a recall. He's going to meet privately with the other two commissioners. I don't know what's going to come out of that. He's refused to apologize. He's refused to resign. He's 82. Don Sterling is 80. There is a sort of generational component to this. Not that it excuses it, but there's probably a little bit of that going on as well. But, for whatever his kind of personal beliefs and his right to free speech, there's kind of a bigger kind of economic, tourism, black eye sort of, no pun intended, potential here to kind of make Wolfboro look quite bad. And so, some residents have said whatever his feelings about this, that's his private business, but this can really hurt the town and its image as a tourist destination. So we haven't heard the last of this. It's gone national. I saw it on a number of national websites. And there's just going to be more and more pressure on him to resign is my guess, I think they'll probably very likely recall him.
Okay, Kevin, I want your thoughts too, but let's go to our listeners. The exchange number again for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Jonathan's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I was calling in because I didn't hear you mention this story in your roundup.
Here
so
we are.
Just happened to be right on. And yeah, my great-great-grandfather fought in the Civil War out of Manchester here. I got him looking at his Civil War chart next to me here now. And, this sort of thing is really, the rest of the country is talking about it, whether New Hampshireites are talking about it or not. Everywhere from the LA Times to New York Magazine, I know many people up here don't care what the rest of the country thinks. But it's a black eye on the state of New Hampshire to have this guy not still in office and being unapologetic about this sort of thing. It's really aggressive, and it paints an all too old stereotype about New Hampshireites and the color of our skin, which is changed.
Jonathan, let me ask you a quick question, and I love that you called and talked about your long descendants work.
I'm a tenth generation of New Hampshireites. Yeah. So I go back to the Revolutionary War here. So.
Well, it's good to hear from you on that. Now, here's a question for you, though. Some people are saying, look, yes, it's offensive what the guy said, but he was at a private, he was out at a restaurant. He was having a private conversation with a friend. It wasn't like he was at an official town meeting where he got up and said this. I mean,
the man's job is for law enforcement. And to defend the least amongst us. And that means every skin color, every religious background, that is the job of a public official. And if you have a public official who's working for the people, speaking those, I don't care where they're speaking it, that does count. This isn't about, oh, look, in public, he's embracing black people. And in private, he's, whatever the group is, a minority or a bunch of, it's just disgusting to me. And it shouldn't, I know people say free speech is the same excuse Donald Sterling is using,
So, Jonathan, and I'm not picking on you. I'm glad you called. Have you ever said anything to your buddies that maybe later you thought, I really hope nobody overheard that?
Yeah, of course. But we're accountable for that sort of thing. And this is not a man who came forward and said, I regret saying this sort of thing. This is a president of our United States as well, who is our president, regardless of who you think he is.
Okay.
And the Tea Party in this state and in the country had played this racial line to the extent that it's disgusting, and it's been able to get away with it because people say, oh, that's just a minority of our party.
Well, Jonathan, really, it's great to hear from you. Thank you very much for joining us. Yeah, Dan Tuohy, what do you think? Some tough stuff here. I mean, again, private conversation. On the other hand, he does hold an important position in the town, so...
Oh, absolutely. It's such a bizarre case, but you know, the time is always right to do what is right. I mean, it's not too late to apologize. In either case, and it's tough to compare the New Hampshire example in Wolfboro to L.A., thankfully. But, yeah, it's just it's unspeakable. That's it. That's all I have to say about it.
Kevin?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, Wolfboro Police Commission. This is an important job. I mean, these folks have incredible power over the police budget, over the police administration. I'm familiar with this concept. Nashville has a police commission. You may recall a Nashville police commissioner resigned and was replaced by Governor Maggie Hassan for assisting a state representative, Dave Campbell, after he had inadvertently run over some ducks. And,
that's right. We talked about that a couple months ago
right,
in the roundup.
And to Dean's point, here's the problem. Wolfboro is one of the crown jewels of New Hampshire during the summer tourism season. When this kind of thing goes viral, people will tell you in the tourism, marketing, branding, business,
damage.
It can do incredible bad damage. Remember how much we got hurt actually financially over the long time it took us to have a holiday honoring Martin Luther King Day. We had groups claiming they were going to boycott the New Hampshire presidential primary, try to convince candidates not to come here. This kind of thing can take on a life of its own, and Dan's absolutely right. He's had not one opportunity, now more than two opportunities to apologize, to do the right thing. Respected leaders like in that town, like Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, has said he should apologize. There's no excuse for this.
Okay, so there's an economic impact is what you guys are saying.
Absolutely.
Okay, again, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. A Gallup survey, gentlemen, this week found New Hampshire among the most generous states. But Dan Tuohy, other organizations that have crunched the numbers over the years, and we've reported on this over the years, say, no, actually, we're among the least generous states. So what gives here?
Yeah, it's different. You know, it seems like every week now we have a poll that New Hampshire's, you know, the top or the bottom, whether it's the smartest kids or the best schools or the cleanest air. This is one of those examples where, you know, traditionally New Hampshire, like Vermont and some of the northeastern states, have not been in that top tier for actually giving financially to various nonprofits. This poll, you know, it is one poll. But we've said this all along that, you know, Chambers of Commerce and nonprofits and the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation says, well, there's a lot of charitable people and businesses in New Hampshire, and they've never gotten due credit. And now they are.
Do you
agree?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the high ranking and the low ranking are not mutually exclusive if you look at the data, because the Gallup poll simply asked, have you donated any money to charity in the last month? And 70% of New Hampshireites said yes. The other,
even if it was 50 cents.
Yes, exactly. The other study simply said that we are the lowest in terms of the median donation per year, something like roughly around $1,500 or 2.5% of discretionary income. So it is quite possible that we have a lot of people who give every month. They just don't give large sums, because that number 50 ranking was in terms of the percent of discretionary income, not how frequently you do it. So certainly, I think this study shows that I think 38% said they had both donated money and volunteered their time in the last month, those are great things. But that other study was talking about the median donation, not so much the frequency. So
actual
dollars. It could be both.
Yeah, and New Hampshire, Kevin, often comes out low on actual dollars, but high on volunteer time.
Right.
A lot of these studies have just looked at dollars, and New Hampshire's near the bottom with that. But Gallup looked at time and money, and it didn't measure the dollars. It just said, have you given?
They did.
And we do give a lot of our time.
We do. And I think that's sort of the ethos of New Hampshire, which is to say, I mean, a state, very low taxes, government very close to the people. I think a lot of people in this state consider giving of their time is more valuable than giving of their money. While in other states which have state income taxes, where these charitable deductions, frankly, are a lot more lucrative in those states with state income taxes, their MO, if you will, is to give of more money than of their time.
All right. Well, again, the number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 800-892-6477 if you want to give us your thoughts on some of the stories that we're covering, including this question of how generous New Hampshire really is. 1-800-892-6477. A couple more State House stories, gentlemen, to follow up on. Dan Tuohy, the Paycheck Fairness Act passed the House by a pretty big margin. The Senate has already unanimously approved this. It's on the way to the governor's desk. Just remind us what this does, Dan.
I'm unfamiliar with the law.
The actually. Paycheck Fairness. Go ahead, Kevin.
Sure. It's the Paycheck Fairness Act bans wage discrimination, particularly against women. Since 1947, New Hampshire has had a wage discrimination ban in place. In 2000, Governor Jean Shaheen created an appeal process for folks who have complaints. This updates the law in the following ways. One, it prohibits employers from disciplining or taking any action against employees who are talking about their wages amongst each other. So the woman employee at the counter realizes, hey, I'm doing the same job as this guy who's working with me and I'm making $2 an hour less. In the past, you could actually fire an employee for having that discussion. With this law,
with the male colleague.
Right. With this law, you cannot. The other big change is that these complaints must be brought within 1 year of the act of alleged discrimination actually occurring. This bill would increase that kind of statute of limitations from 1 year to 3 years.
And that was an issue, Kevin, right? Should it be 1 year? Should it be 3 years? Businesses said 3 years is way too long to, you know, rifle through all the papers and so forth.
Right. And businesses essentially said, look, we already have to keep a lot of these records for 4 years anyway regarding any complaints that are brought against us. A lot of business arguments essentially was if you allow a 3-year statute of limitations, you're actually encouraging the system to respond more slowly than it does right now.
It's okay. So the bill as it stands, going to Governor DeHasson's desk, has the 1 year?
Has the 3 year.
Has the 3 year.
3 year statute of limitations, yes. And that's what happened this week. The House committee initially had agreed with business, gone back to one. This is a big priority for House Speaker Terry Norelli, who's retiring this year. She did not want this bill to go to a conference committee. She wanted to be over and done with it. She wanted the 3-year statute, which originally the House Labor Committee had agreed with. The second committee had changed it. She convinced the House to go back to the 3 year. She actually left the rostrum as Speaker of the House in order to speak on the bill. Very important.
That's unusual, isn't it?
Very unusual. First time she's done it this year.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Speaking of Terry Norelli retiring, stepping down after a long time in the New Hampshire House, more political retirements, Dean Spiliotis, who joined that group this week.
Yes. Well, we know three Republicans who are retiring, three Republican senators, Jim Roush of Derry, Bob O'Dell of New London, which I think we've mentioned before, and Peter Bragdon of Milford. All three of them, what's interesting about this from a political perspective is all three of them at different times have worked in a bipartisan way on things like the gas tax, Medicaid expansion, reducing carbon emissions through REGI. So some folks view them as kind of moderate Republicans. Their districts have a somewhat moderate edge to them. But Roush and O'Dell in particular are already conservatives who have stepped up to challenge for those seats. And Peter Bragdon, as we know, is going to leave his position to continue on with his work with the former LGC
local government center.
Yes, exactly. So the question is going to be politically whether these three seats will go to others who are sort of a similar ideological profile, or perhaps it may change the it could in theory change the complexion of the Senate if conservatives are able to take these seats.
Now, Dan, I'd love your thoughts too. Three moderate Republicans retiring from the state Senate.
Yes, and of course, Peter Bragdon, being the former Senate president, he really has done his mark. And upon his retirement, he's, of course, the governor, Senator Larson, and others have given him plaudits. But it's a couple of really interesting primaries this year that on both sides that are just amazing. And of course, over in Seacoast with State Senator Nancy Stiles faces a primary from Steve Kenda, the local businessman from Northampton. That's another race. So there's a lot of intra-party dialogue that's going on that will really in some way be like a backdrop to what's going on in the U.S. Senate race here in New Hampshire. Some of these business issues, jobs, the Affordable Care Act. Some of these same issues have the underpinnings that will be discussed at the state level as well.
Interesting. So some of these national issues play out in our state Senate races because, you know, did you take the money to implement the Affordable Care Act and so forth? Or how are you trying to do
it? Correct. Yeah, the Medicaid expansion vote, you know, some of the like Citizens for a Strong New Hampshire came out with that radio ad, you know, criticizing three Republicans. Very, very strong ad. I've not heard it, but I've seen the transcript. And it just talks about wolves in sheep's clothing for Senator Jeb Bradley, David Booten, and Nancy Stiles, based on, in part, on the Medicaid expansion vote and for Senator Stiles on the proposal to raise the state gas tax.
Yeah, Kevin, you wrote about this. Tell us a little bit more that some of these other state senators, not the three who are retiring, obviously, but three other state senators who have worked across the aisle are being targeted.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Citizens for Strong New Hampshire is a new conservative group that's been very politically active. As Dan said, we're seeing here really interesting, and Dean mentioned it too, we're seeing an interesting dynamic here in the Republican primary in 2014. Groups like Americans for Prosperity, Citizens for Strong New Hampshire, the Republican Liberty Caucus, if you will. All these folks look at the state Senate and they essentially say, these folks have gone native on us. They voted for a Medicaid expansion plan. They voted to raise the gas tax. They agreed with the governor on too many priorities. They're going after who they consider to be moderate senators. Now, Hampton Republican Senator Nancy Stiles may not perfectly fit the description of a moderate state senator, nor would former Republican Congressman and Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley. He is pro-choice on abortion. That kind of puts him in the moderate category many times. The third senator is Manchester Republican Dave Booten. But all of these folks voted for the Medicaid expansion plan. Two out of the three voted for the gas tax increase. And many of these organizations are particularly upset. I don't want to really get into the weeds here. But there was legislation this past week that passed that requires disclosure by groups to in-state elections that didn't have to disclose before. A lot of these folks are groups like Americans for Prosperity and others are taxable nonprofits, the so-called 501c organizations, haven't had to report their receipts or their expenditures. This bill that is sponsored by Senator Bradley would require them to disclose all of their spending and would require them to disclose how much they raise, but not who their individual donors are.
So it's not a full 100% disclosure, but it's partial disclosure of some of these outside groups.
It's a partial one. In this ad that Dan alluded to essentially says, and these senators want to prevent us from publicly complaining about their vote. It really doesn't do that, but it highlights how upset a lot of these special interest groups are about having to disclose their activity.
All right. Well, coming up, it's unfair but true that cold, long, harsh winter apparently did nothing to harm the state's tick population. We'll find out more. What have you noticed so far in terms of those ticks? Give us a call. We'll be back in just a moment with more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki testifies before Congress on treatment delays at health clinics, and the FCC votes on a net neutrality proposal, and then American drones aid the search for the missing Nigerian schoolgirls. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats, providing evaluations and surgical interventions for athletic injuries, sosmed.org. And Clean Yield Asset Management, Norwich, Vermont, tailoring client portfolios for financial performance and social impact, including investment in local agriculture. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, the death penalty debate and buffer zones around abortion clinics. Two big stories from the legislature this week. We'll follow up more with them on Monday. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us on some of the stories that we're covering. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's take another call. This is Roger in Stratham. Hi, Roger. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning, Laura. Yeah, a couple of points. I wanted to get back to the generosity of New Hampshire citizens.
Sure.
We have our own studies here in New Hampshire. The Carsey Institute, New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, show that, we're ranked number 50 or so in terms of charitable giving. But if you pull out churches, religious giving, we bump up to number 12.
Oh, that's interesting.
And New Hampshire is a secular state for the most part. So news isn't terrible. And in terms of volunteerism, I think, citing both the Carsey and New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies again, we're ranked around number 30, number 29. I don't have the exact figure. So we're not a state of volunteers. We don't outshine a lot of other states, is my point. Although volunteerism is important and makes a significant impact.
Okay, Roger.
Specific organization.
Intriguing stuff. Thank you very much for calling in. And Dean, I had not heard, and he makes a great point, that I had heard that because we are not a big church-going state, our overall charitable donations, cash donations, are lower. But that's interesting. He says there's a study that actually pulled the church piece out and then found out that, you know, in terms of a secular state, we're not too bad.
Right. I mean, that's the trick with this kind of stuff, is to be able to properly dice and slice the data.
Yeah.
Sure, you know, traditionally, churches play in our society play a big role in terms of charitable works and donations. So you can see how that might affect it. And as you mentioned, I think we're the second least religious state in terms of church attendance behind Vermont, I think. So that's where that comes from.
All right. Well, Roger, thank you very much. Intriguing stuff. I did want to ask you very quickly, Kevin Landrigan, I'm sure we'll be talking about this again on later roundups, but real quickly, there was some movement this week on the Medicaid enhancement tax. The House and Senate both looking at what to do next, given that two courts have both found this tax unconstitutional. Without going into the details of, you know, who, what, when, where, why about this tax, because it's got a long history, how much of a budget hole are we talking about if this tax goes away?
Well, potentially it could be as much as $190 million a year.
Per year. Wow.
But there is a belief that the hole would not be that big. Here's why. Under the Affordable Care Act, as more people become insured, there's every expectation our insurance premium tax is going to kind of roar into place and provide a couple of tens of millions of dollars more for the insurance premium tax. Under Medicaid expansion, there should be less uncompensated care at hospitals, free or reduced care given to people who don't have insurance.
That's the hope. We don't know yet.
Correct. But once these folks have coverage, some of that free care should be reduced. The Medicaid enhancement tax is used to provide payments to hospitals by the state to compensate for some of that free care that's provided.
You know, Senator Chuck Morse said, Dean Spiliotis, on this, that, you know, the House has passed its approach, the Senate has passed its approach. Morse basically said, we all know there will be a committee of conference on this, possibly two. What's the basic message there,
right,
Dean?
Well, that there's going to have to be some level of compromise. I love the politics of conference committees, because you really find out what people's sticking points are. You know, you have the House going in saying, well, we'll reduce it a little bit, but we're going to broaden the tax base, and the Senate saying, no, we're just going to reduce it and phase it out. You know, those are kind of initial negotiation points. They'll probably end up somewhere in between. But that's what conference committees are for. You know, a lot of deal making and a little bit of arm twisting, and you kind of find out what people's real preferences are, what they're willing to do. So, I mean, this is sort of a difficult issue to really sort of figure out the intricacies. I think it is interesting that it is so confusing that both bills in the House and the Senate have language intended to kind of clarify why the tax works as it does. So whenever you have to, like, put into the legislation clarification, you know that there's a problem. Plus, you know, we still have the whole court proceedings on the constitutionality kind of hanging over our heads as well. We've had the two Superior Court decisions. We're waiting to see what the state Supreme Court does. So not the last we've heard of this.
Yeah, it hasn't been ruled out completely yet. But it seems like, Dean, everybody's just expecting
it.
Seems like it's headed towards,
and that's a big, it's potentially a big revenue haul in the budget that they're going to have to deal with.
Well, I want to ask all of you about a story that really got my attention. And it's not a great radio story, Dan Tuohy, because it's about a young man from New Hampshire, a Yale college student, who is walking across the country without speaking a word. Now, who is this, and why is he doing this? It's a terrific story.
Sure, yeah. It's a great young man. It's Greg Hindy. He's a Nashua High grad, also from Yale. It's a vow of silence. It's a photography, large format photography project of his to walk across the country. He left last July. He's looking to wrap it up in L.A. on his birthday. I believe it's July 9th. But as he's going across, I mean, I did talk to his dad. He, of course, he's on a vow of silence, and he's not using electronic devices except in an emergency. But so Greg Hindy's he's walking across the country, and like many people on these long distance treks, he's going where the road takes him. So he was in Idaho, and he was on the Lewis and Clark Trail for a bit, and he's taking some fantastic photographs. And of course, he's sending stuff back to his dad. To develop film and everything else. And he's really finding out that America's a pretty amazing place with, friends along the road helping him out. And he's got quite a following. I believe his website is greghindy.com.
So he is sort of posting about this. There's some communication.
He's not posting. I think his dad is.
His dad is.
And his dad maintains the Facebook group.
Interesting. You wonder how he, and I've heard that he's gotten help from people along the way. At one point he was, dehydrated or was ill, and he got help even if he's not communicating. He's under a vow of silence.
He did, yeah. His dad was saying he went to like a convenience store, and he may have gotten food poisoning from like an egg salad sandwich or something like that. And of course he essentially wrote something down on a note and then essentially passed out in the store, and he got rehydrated, or may have been dehydration. But he's back up, and he's lugging a 60-pound trailer with his large format camera and his other gear. So it's not just like he has a 6,000 cubic inch backpack. He's got a lot of gear that's really an impressive endurance feat here.
Oh, that's amazing. Dean?
Yeah, and he has said his mantra is no electronics, no technology, no entertainment. Only what's inside his own head. He's mentioned mindfulness and meditation. There's almost kind of a Zen sort of Buddhist element to this, where he's just sort of being in the country and experiencing it as he encounters it. It's really kind of a neat project.
Well, the other part of the story, maybe you know more about this, Dan Tuohy, is he was in med school. He had some sort of a project he had to do. He stopped at a flea market to buy a camera, and all of a sudden just, got completely enraptured by this camera and photography, and said, "Forget med school. I'm walking across the country with my camera." I mean, boy,
exactly. For younger generation, the large format camera, it takes a while to set this up. So it's not like the rest of us with smartphones snapping a photograph or a selfie. It takes a bit of a process to set up the camera. And his dad relayed an interesting anecdote where he goes to like fast food places to set up his darkroom, so to speak, to develop the camera or some of the film. So he said he usually gets a lot of questions about that when he's in the corner of a fast food restaurant setting up his big tent, if you will, to develop the film.
Wow. Maybe we'll follow up on this when he hits Los Angeles. It's a very interesting story. I do want to go back to our listeners and remind you that the number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Find us on Twitter if you want as well. Let's go to Dover. Ron's waiting there. Hi, Ron. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's Rod Paul. And many, many years ago, I used to cover the legislature. And I found back then that accounting for the activities of the actual lobbyists provided more information often than what the legislature, the individual legislators said and did, mainly because the people who really seem to know what's going on are the lobbyists, or were back then. And I don't find much discussion about individual lobbyists and the amount of power and sway and ability they have.
You know, Ron, this is a terrific point. It feeds into what you said earlier, Kevin, about this bill concerning campaign cash disclosures.
Yeah, it does, certainly, and it's great to hear from Rod Paul, who's from New Hampshire Times and other publications, really an institution in our business, and thank you so much for calling us in. I think the role of lobbyists in New Hampshire is as great now as it was back then, to be sure. A lot of money is spent. A lot of information is given, as we've talked about on this program before. When you have a legislature that doesn't have any salary to speak of, $100 plus mileage, and you don't have staff, which all of the House members, all 400 of them, don't have any staff at all, then your lobbyists become the purveyors of information. And that's why very often you'll see, show up in a committee, 20-page amendment to this bill that rewrites a bill. It's been written by a lobbyist for the legislator. The legislator agrees with the policy of the lobbyist, and the lobbyist goes to work writing that amendment. We sort of have an honor system here, and sometimes I think it works and sometimes I don't. And by that I mean this. In a lot of states, there's a lot more regulation on lobbyists than there are here in New Hampshire. A lot more disclosure is required. Bans on contributions from lobbyists are common in many states. They don't exist here in New Hampshire. The honor system is, as it's been explained to me by legislative leaders back down through the decades, is if a lobbyist is acting unethically, we ferret them out and we blackball them, and they don't have any business here in New Hampshire. And I've seen that happen to some on an isolated basis, but like I said, you're sort of relying on not only the goodwill but the investigative talents of a lot of legislators to ferret out who's ethical and who isn't.
Okay, Rod, thank you for the call. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, and like Kevin was saying, he made some great points, but this session, perhaps more than previous sessions, there's been a lot more focus on where did this legislation come from, whether it's model legislation from ALEC or the National Conference of State Legislatures. I think state reps and state senators are more savvy about wondering, all right, where is this information coming from? What's the source?
Because we see more national outside groups acting at the state legislative level. They used to almost focus on Congress. Now they're active in states around the country.
Yes, exactly. And there's been some legislation filed. I'm not sure what's the status of it, but like wondering, specifying where the research is coming from.
All right. Well, Rod, thank you for the call. And Dean Spiliotis, I don't want to ask you about this, but I have to.
I'm ready.
You know what I'm going to ask you. In the depths of that long polar vortex winter, I remember thinking, okay, at least this will kill more ticks, because we always hear that warmer winters lead to greater tick populations. Alas, this week, I found out I was wrong. What did we learn?
Yeah, this is interesting. And for anybody who has children and pets, particularly dogs like I do, you're well acquainted with ticks. And I grew up in a wetlands area, and I remember playing in the tall grass and coming out just kind of covered, although back then there wasn't this big a concern about Lyme disease. What we found out was that because there was this heavy blanket of snow for so long, it essentially locked all the humidity into the ground. And it's not a freezing issue. It's a dryness issue that takes care of the tick population.
So it needs to be super cold and super dry?
Dry, right. And so this locked in like 100 – the snow blanket locked in like 100% humidity, which kept the tick population active. And these little essentially baby ticks, I guess, they're called tick nymphs. They look like poppy seeds. Are very active right now. So you think traditionally it's still kind of cold out. It's not really summer. We don't need to worry. This is actually a peak period for the next month and a half or so, which I did not know either, even though I often am picking them off of my dog. So it's a concern, and it's interesting. I have friends who have traditionally said, well, you know, Lyme disease doesn't come up this far into New Hampshire. But,
oh, no.
right. But that no longer is applicable. We have the highest rate of Lyme disease in the country. But it's more prevalent in the sea coast and in the southern counties. But it is here. And it's a reality. I know now my dog is vaccinated for Lyme disease, which is something that my vet started in the last year or so. So it's increasingly common.
Okay. Well, this is outside everybody's expertise, but it has always struck me. We've got vaccinations for dogs. I've got this liquid that I put on our cats once a month, and they're fine. And I'm wondering where that vaccination or liquid is for me, Kevin Landrigan.
Yeah, and it's Lyme disease, as we've said, is an increasing phenomenon here. I have a brother-in-law in southeastern Massachusetts. He got Lyme disease a couple of years ago in his late 50s, had serious complications.
That's
from
tough.
It.
Yeah.
And then just over a month ago, has come down with diverticulitis and was in the hospital for a week. Now, is one related to the other? Well, they don't really know. The doctors can't tell them. But Lyme disease, if it's not caught initially, can really devastate the immune system in the future and create real health complications down the road for people. So if you feel something on your body, get it off very quickly. Doctors will tell you if you act within 48 hours, there's a very quick treatment that really takes care of everything. A good friend of mine at the State House had that happen to him this past week, went to the doctor, had the treatment, and all is good.
All right. Forewarned is forearmed. And, Dean, very quickly, we need to give a big on-air pat on the back to Alex Preston, the UNH student from Mount Vernon. He's been wowing audiences on American Idol. He made it to the top three. He came to New Hampshire last weekend for his big homecoming visit. And then what happened last night, Dean?
Yeah, well, he was eliminated last night. So he is not one of the two finalists who will perform, I believe, next Tuesday. He will be performing in the finale on Wednesday with Jason Mraz, a well-known pop singer. Yeah, you know, there was some sense that the other two finalists are sort of these sort of big performers, lots of running around and you know, much sort of higher energy. He's a little more kind of nuanced and subtle.
Someone
singer,
called him the quiet dark horse.
Yeah. And, you know, the beautiful thing for him is that, you know, there have been as many runner-ups who have been successful in their career as American Idol than the actual winner. So, you know, you finish in the top four, top 10, you still have a very good shot. You know, people now know who he is. You know, hopefully for him, it'll lead to a record contract. It's fantastic visit. It really is a transformative experience for these young musicians, and
Absolutely.
It's fun to watch.
Well, congratulations to Alex. It's great, and it's been a lot of fun watching what happens to him. Dan Tuohy, what are you going to be covering next week?
Unfortunately, I'll be covering the funeral services for Officer Arkell.
Yeah.
And on a lighter note, it's New Hampshire Restaurant Week, so that starts today. So I'll be hopefully zipping around the state, hitting a few restaurants.
Right. There are a lot of services and remembrances and so forth next week. And probably more information, Dan, coming out about just what the heck happened. So you'll be there. Kevin, what are you doing next week?
Well, this is one of my favorite times of year. It really refers to the horse trading season that begins the conference committee process, kind of like New Hampshire's version of Pawn Stars, you know. meaning, as Dean was saying before, you bring in a Mickey Mouse-looking figure, and Rick behind the table says, I'm only willing to give you $100 for that. And you think, well, am I going to walk away, or am I going to take the $100? That's what happens at the negotiating table between the House and Senate. House members have to decide, am I going to walk away because this senator has just stripped my bill to almost nothing, or am I going to take a little bit of nothing?
Okay, some people love March Madness. Kevin Landrigan loves conference committee season. Good for
know.
You, Kevin. Dean, how about you?
I'm with Kevin. Maybe we can develop like a conference committee pool that we can do. So I'm going to be watching. You know, they have to wrap up by June 5th. I'm also going to watch the situation at Wolfboro because it really is remarkable. You know, it's clearly an embarrassment for the town and for the state. And we're going to see what comes out of this private meeting with the individual.
All right. Thanks for being here, gentlemen. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, one last attempt this year to wipe out the death penalty. A repeal bill passes the House and is now before the state Senate. Then, our earlier conversation about rising childhood anxiety. What's normal, what isn't, and what role parents play. And later, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam on his new book about Joseph Smith, founder of the Mormon Church. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Bedford Falls Assisted Living and Memory Care Community, with a team of dedicated caregivers working with families to improve the quality of aging, bedfordfallsassistedliving.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord,
89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki faces tough questions from senators over long delays at VA clinics around the country. Shinseki says he's mad as hell, but he will not resign. The FCC approves a controversial net neutrality plan that would allow content